Okay, we are now featuring these open forums in cities across America, even overseas. And how we typically run this is we begin the session with a brief report on some of the very latest scientific discoveries that are making belief in God more credible than they have been before. And once a couple of hands start popping up, then we stop the report and begin to deal with the open forum, which means you can raise any question you want that pertains to faith, science, the Bible, other religions, other philosophies. Anything goes. The only rule we have on this session is that if you have 8 questions, you have to let someone else ask a question between your first question and your second question. So everybody gets to ask whatever questions they want, but one question per turn. I think we've got microphones set up. You can come to the microphones. If you're too shy to come to the microphone, you'll have to speak up because I'll need to repeat your question for the benefit of those that can't make it today and are going to be listening to the audio tape of this session. But if at all possible, please come to the microphone. Yes? Jeannie? Yes?
Can we give up the roving mics that we're just going to have? Leave them like they are,
Oh, you want to have roving mics?
Well, that was your request. You want
all right, you can sit where you are. We'll bring the microphone to you. That's even better. All right. We'll do it that way. And by the way, if things run a little bit slow, I came equipped this morning with 11 discoveries from the past few weeks. It's just the past few weeks. So if things slow down, I'm going to go back to talking about more discoveries, all right? And I had intended to prepare a handout this morning that you could all take. This would have been our latest design evidences for a life support planet. And as I was working on this over the weekend, I realized we weren't going to be ready because what I had here typed up were 92 separate evidences that the solar system has been designed by God for the benefit of man. And now the list is at 95. So just over the weekend, we've gone from 92 to 95. But we will be preparing this and putting it on our website at reasons.org. And if you're not into that, you can get a hard copy from us as well. But one of the things that we have been developing over the past few weeks is the fact that there are certain elements that are very critical in terms of their abundance on the crust of planet Earth. To give you one example, this is the first one discovered. It was molybdenum. And most of us realize that molybdenum is a vital element for the chemistry of advanced animals. And so you can go into your health food store and get these molybdenum supplements. However, I would warn you that it may not be a good idea to take a strong dose of that molybdenum. Molybdenum is also a deadly poison. And what we notice is that for advanced life, human beings in particular, there's a very sensitive fine-tuning of the amount of molybdenum you want in your diet. You want enough to keep these life essential enzymes being built within your body. If you don't get enough molybdenum, you're in trouble. But if you get slightly a little bit more than what's enough, you're in trouble as well. And we're now discovering that there are several elements like this. Molybdenum is the one that's probably the most sensitive. You have to have exactly the right amount in your diet or you're in big trouble. But that's also true of an element called vanadium. It's also true of selenium. You may have heard of selenium, and there have been a lot of warnings on television about not taking too much selenium. A lot of people don't get enough, but if you take too much, that could cause trouble. Chromium. You've probably seen chromium tablets in the health food stores. Well, watch out if you load up on too much chromium. It will also poison you. You need it, but if you take too much, it will poison you. Copper is another one. So there's 5 elements where you have to be careful about how much you ingest. You want to make sure you ingest enough, but not too much. Now, how this figures into the design of the solar system is that these are elements we get from the crust of the Earth. You know, plants grow in the crust. They take in these elements. We eat the plants, and that's how we get these nutrients. And if the plants are absorbing too much, then you get into trouble. And what you really want is a planet that's got just the right amount of these five elements in the crust. Just the right amount of copper, vanadium, selenium, chromium, and molybdenum. Not too much, not too little. But as geophysicists look at the crust of the Earth, we realize how exceptional it is. Now, you're not going to find the right amounts of these elements in any other crustal structure of another planet or a satellite, a moon. Earth is unique in the sense that it has exactly the right amounts of these five essential elements in the Earth's crust, not too much, not too little. And this is stuff that we've been discovering just in the last 12 months. And there may be more elements that we'll be picking up as we continue to do research. But if you've looked at our video journey toward creation, you'll understand how it is that our Earth got blessed with exactly the right amount of these elements. Namely, that the sun formed very close to a supernova eruption. Not too close, otherwise it would have been obliterated, but not too distant, otherwise it wouldn't have picked up enough of these elements. Where do these elements come from? They come from supernova eruptions. And your typical star system in our galaxy is woefully short of all of these elements. But our solar system had the good fortune of forming right next to one of these supernova eruptions, so it got an extra heavy dose of these elements. And but again, you don't want to form too close, don't want to form too far away. Likewise, the timing is essential. If the solar system is forming just when this eruption takes place, then it gets destroyed. You want it to form a little bit later, but if it forms too much later, then it doesn't get to pick up enough of these elements. And this is why when we look at the stars in our solar system, we realize that the sun, in fact, the sun is the only old star we found that has got so much of these five elements. It's the only one. We do see younger stars that have equivalent amounts of these five elements. But the sun is the only old star. And you say, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, you're not going to get life around a young star. The young stars are far too unstable. You've got to wait for them to age a little bit before they pick up enough stability, kind of like with human beings. Okay, same principle. You have to wait before they enter into this stable phase. But as such, even then, you don't get enough. And what happened in the case of the Earth amongst the nine planets of our solar system, Earth had the good fortune of getting an extra dose of these heavy elements when a body twice the mass of Mars collided with the Earth 4.25 billion years ago. What happened is all the heavy stuff from the collider got transferred to the Earth's crust. All the light stuff formed a debris cloud that made up the moon. And so by that means, Earth is by far and away the richest in these elements. On the other hand, if it was a little bit too much transferred, then we'd all be poisoned by these elements. What are the probabilities of this happening by chance? And that's kind of what we bring out in here. And let me tell you another one before I give you the bottom line on this. This paper just got published in the European Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics. In fact, it's not quite out yet. This is a preprint I've been able to get. It's going to be published in April. And it says, yes, the sun is located at the co-rotation circle. And what it's referring there to is that when you look at our galaxy, the stars are orbiting about the center of the galaxy. Then you have the orbit of what's called the spiral pattern. So the spiral arms that make up our galaxy, they have their particular orbit around the center of our galaxy. And typically, the stars will orbit at a different rate than the spiral structure. The only place where that doesn't happen is what's called the co-rotation distance. There's only one distance from the center of our galaxy where the spiral structure goes around our galaxy at exactly the same rate at which stars at that distance would go around the center of our galaxy. And our sun is located exactly at that co-rotation distance. And you say, well, why is that so important? Well, we wrote an article in our Facts and Faith News magazine, I think it was three issues ago, making the point that our sun is located between spiral arms, and how that makes not only life possible on our planet Earth, but actually gives us a window to see the heavens. If we were inside a spiral arm, then there'd be so much gas and dust there that all we'd be able to see is a few stars around us and nothing else. We wouldn't even be able to tell that we're inside a galaxy. We wouldn't be able to tell that there are other galaxies or quasars. Well, so when it says in the Bible, the heavens declare the glory of God, we need to recognize, unless we're placed just right, we don't even get to see very much of the heavens at all, and therefore we wouldn't be able to recognize the glorious hand of God behind it. But there's something much more profound about that location between spiral arms. If you're within a spiral arm, or even close to a spiral arm, what dominates the structure of these spiral arms are these hot newborn stars. And these hot newborn stars blast their environment with intense ultraviolet and X-ray radiation. Now, this would have the impact of stripping the atmospheres off the planets. Now, that'd be just one consequence. Another consequence would be the radiation itself. Bottom line, if you're inside one of these spiral arms, life, at least advanced life, will not be supportable. It's not going to be able to survive because of that particular problem. The other thing is you stand a good chance of being disrupted by the gravitational tugs of the stars, because inside the spiral arm, the star density is quite high. The stars are jammed much more tightly together than they are between the spiral arms. I mean, you look at a spiral galaxy, you can see the star density is high inside the spiral arm. It's low outside the spiral arm. And so what would happen there is the sun with its bunch of planets is sitting there in that spiral arm. Other stars are going to gravitationally pull on those planets and yank the Earth out of its life support zone. So for that reason, astronomers recognize you can't have a life support planet inside a spiral arm or even close to a spiral arm. Now, if the sun wasn't at the co-rotation distance from the center of our galaxy, then that means the spiral structure would revolve at a little different rate than the sun revolves around the center of our galaxy, which means it'd only be a matter of time before the sun would come into contact with a spiral arm and destroy the capacity for life. Therefore, the only place where life is going to be possible in our galaxy is a star that's in between spiral arms and at the co-rotation distance. So when we look at the vastness of the stars in our galaxy, namely 100 billion, we're only looking at a few that are going to be at that right position in our galaxy where life will be possible. And of those few, you need a star of exactly the mass of our sun in order to give the right amount of luminosity to support life on a planet going around it. So when people look at the billions and billions of stars in our galaxy, we need to realize, hey, maybe we're the only star that exists in the whole galaxy that's at that right position of the right mass for the support of life, let alone the other 90 characteristics that we'd be needing to examine. But yeah, what the bottom line on this is as of last night, we're looking at 95 different characteristics of the solar system that must be fine-tuned for life to be possible in our solar system. The probability that all 95 conditions will be met is less than one chance in 10 to the 123. And the standard rebuttal from the non-theists is, well, yes, but you haven't taken into account that there might be lots of planets in the universe. Well, the maximum estimate for the number of planets that could exist in the observable universe stands at 10 to the 21. So what that means is you'd simply be knocking off 21 zeros off those 123, which leaves you in the best of situations, less than one chance in 10 to the 102 that you're going to find even one planet anywhere in the entire universe with the capacity to support life. And 102 zeros should be enough to convince any skeptic that we're not looking at naturalism. You need supernaturalism to explain the existence of a planet like Earth with the capacity to support life. So we'll be making available a list of these characteristics there is one available already on our website, but it's out of date. We'll be giving you a new update of all 95 of these characteristics and the bottom line of probability. Okay. The very latest on Mars, this just got published in the journal Science. The latest update on Mars, and Mars has been a favorite subject of discussion because NASA scientists are excited about the possibility that there was water on Mars and a very abundant water cycle and therefore the possibility of life. It's interesting how often you read this literature and they say liquid water equals life. Well, as you discover in looking at this thing, liquid water is only one of the 95 things you need. Liquid water is not enough. And if you want proof of that, boil some water on top of your stove, leave the water alone after it cools off, and see how long it takes before life shows up there, all right? Water has only one requirement. And incidentally, water is very abundant in the universe. It is quite rare to have liquid water anywhere in the universe, but water in the solid state, water in the gaseous state, is really very common. Everywhere we astronomers look, we see loads of water, and for obvious reasons. Hydrogen is the most abundant element we see in the universe. Oxygen is the third most abundant element we see in the universe. So water should be present lots of places in the cosmos. And that's not the problem. Water is not the issue. The issue is all the other things you need besides water. But one of the things they've just discovered in looking very carefully at all these surveyor photos of Mars is this message that we were taught a year ago that these channels we see on Mars are the result of water runoff from very heavy rainfalls that were taking place early in the history of Mars. And at least the NASA team has been conceding that all along, that water didn't last long on Mars. It was only in its very earliest years that this water was there. And given how massive Mars is and where it's placed, that water is going to dissipate quickly to outer space. I'll get to you as soon as I finish this little report. Okay, we got a hand already. So I'll stop my reports once I get through this. But what the latest photos reveal is that we're not looking at runoff from rainfall. What we're looking at is runoff from subterranean water being forced to the surface, because they found these channels and then they see these cirques. And normally you'd expect that what you're going to have is a lot of evidence of runoff from the high elevations over the cirque down into the valley, into lower areas, and it's going to accumulate somewhere. That's not what we're seeing on Mars. What we're seeing on Mars is that, yes, you have these channels, but there's nothing contributing to the channels from higher elevations. What we're seeing is the evidence of water being pulled from below the surface, forced up, probably through some early tectonic activity, and then it begins to flow. And it's interesting, you'll see channels on Mars that start, stop, start, and stop. And so it's like what happens is the water gets forced to the surface, but before any dramatic happens, it's dissipating to outer space. And so now the NASA team is realizing what we're seeing on ancient Mars is evidence for liquid water damage on the surface of Mars, but we're not seeing evidence for any kind of a water cycle on Mars. And they believe that the water was pushed to the surface through tectonic activity that could be attributed to an early magnetic field. That's the other thing that's coming out. They now realize that Mars did have a magnetic field, but it was short-lived. And why would it be short-lived? Well, unlike Earth, it didn't have a huge amount of cobalt, nickel, and iron in the core. It's got very little of that. Earth is the one exception, or solar system, because of that collision with a body twice the mass of Mars. It picked up a huge dose of cobalt, nickel, and iron, a lot of which sunk to the core, and set up a stable magnetic dynamo. You know, Earth is that one planet in our solar system that's got this strong, stable magnetic field, and that's what enables our plate tectonics and volcanism to be sustained for a long time. It's also what protects our atmosphere. If we didn't have that strong magnetic field, the solar wind would sputter away our atmosphere. and very quickly our atmosphere would no longer be able to sustain life. And now when they look at Mars, they realize that's what happened. The magnetic field simply wasn't sustained for a very long period of time, and when it stopped, the tectonic activity stopped, and the water was no longer being forced to the surface. And also with the stopping of the magnetic field, the solar wind began to sputter away the atmosphere, and now a liquid drop of water on the surface of Mars evaporates in 1 second, and it quickly dissipates to Mars. The other thing they discovered is there's a whole lot less water in the polar caps than they once thought, only half of what they had been measuring before. And so this is, I think, helping our research scientists recognize the Earth is a lot more special than what we had thought before. Okay, I'm going to take a question from the back here. We'll take more questions. Feeling enough questions, we'll keep going through these reports. Yes.
I read recently in an article, actually at the Griffith Observatory, that there was a fossil from Mars of a bacterial fossils.
Yes. Well, there's a famous one that was announced 2 years ago by the group up in the Bay Area, David Mackay's team, where they found that, I think it's ALH84001. But they've now withdrawn the claims that they've got microfossils in that particular rock. And that's because they discovered that the little spherical structures they were finding, the worm-like structures they were finding, were an artifact of the preservative they put on the rock. So they said, well, and then they recognized, too, that the chemicals that they thought were signatures of life chemistry were all made at high temperatures, not low temperatures. And we're talking temperatures in excess of 500 degrees centigrade, then it can't possibly be biological. And so the scientific community now recognizes this is kind of akin to cold fusion. It got a lot of publicity when it's been announced, and the public is now finally realizing this is not a credible claim. David Mackay's team, just a couple of weeks ago, announced that they had found another Martian meteorite that had microfossils in it. And I think it made the press about 10 days ago, and it's gotten quite a bit of attention. But the scientific community said, David Mackay, there you go again. So it's what I saw described in Science Journal was that this announcement got an underwhelming response from the scientific community. There are no chemicals that they've been able to put in with the claim like they did with ALH84001. They're just finding these little micro fossils. And when they call them microfossils, you've got to be careful. All they have is evidence for small spheres in this thing. There's no evidence of nucleation inside the sphere, none of the things that you would normally attribute to a claim of a microfossil. So all you see is this kind of a spherical shell. That's it. And as the researchers have been pointing out to David Mackay, there are all kinds of inorganic processes that will deliver the same kind of microfossils. I mean, when the discovery was made 2 years ago, they said it could be the preservative coating that was put on this. There's also reactions that would take place as a meteor goes through the atmosphere that could produce these little micro so-called fossils, or it could even be indigenous. This might have been some natural chemical reaction on Mars that could have produced these, and we do see these things in Earth rocks. And all along, I remember 2 years ago when David Mackay's team brought up the first claim, how many in the scientific community said if we found those microfossils in an Earth rock, nobody would claim it was a fossil of life. It's only because it's in a Mars rock that people have jumped to this conclusion. And maybe we should apply the same skepticism to Mars rocks that we would apply to Earth rocks. And I think that's a good point. Okay, anyone else? Yes.
Don Lindemann from Washington. You're welcome at our bed and breakfast place anytime. You've been to Japan, and there are certain mission organizations and pastors over there that ask and you not return because you confuse the gospel of Jesus Christ with your old age theories and your theistic evolution. I wonder if you shouldn't go back to Japan.
Well, I'm planning to go back to Japan in May. It'll be my fourth trip. But yes, there are a number of missionaries, and especially church pastors there, that really wish I would never go to Japan. And Yeah, in my trips around the world, the thing that I've observed is that the Japanese church, more than any other national church, has bought into this young earth creationist perspective. And that, I think, is one of the prime reasons why the Japanese church has remained so tiny. You know, Japan, I think, would be one of the most difficult nations in the world to try to promote that kind of biblical doctrine. I put biblical in quotes. This is a nation where people are well-trained in science and engineering and technology. It's also a nation where they're taught the tenets of Darwinian evolution from grade one onwards. This, you know, the science issues are a significant challenge. I've been trying to encourage missionaries going to Japan that you have to start with scientific evidence, given the population you're dealing with. And what's made it difficult is the Japanese church is dominated by something that most Japanese would consider to be very anti-scientific and very anti-intellectual. And it's interesting that the Japanese church is typically small congregations. Typical congregation size is 30. And the ratio of men to women is 95 to 5. It's 95% women. And most of the women are young and single. So if you often walk into a Japanese church and there's all these young single ladies and one pastor is in his 50s. I mean, you know, how attractive is that environment to, say, a man who's a career professional walking in with his family? I've never seen such a feminized church as in Japan, but I've also never seen a church that is so anti-intellectual and anti-scientific in its stance. And so, yeah, Japan is the one country in the world where I've been vilified more than anywhere else. I arrived there, they called me a false prophet, a tool of Satan, you name it. Every name, just because I believe that the universe was billions of years old. And I tried to mollify them by saying, look, I do believe in a literal Adam and Eve that was created only thousands of years ago, but that wasn't good enough. They took the position that if you don't believe that it's 4004 BC for the universe and the earth, not just for Adam and Eve, then you're damaging the gospel. What we've been doing in the last several trips is really try to deal with a new kind of church in Japan. I think what's encouraging to our reasons to believe, we have a reasons to believe in Japan. Website, we got books in the Japanese language now. Reason why I'm going in May is a second one of our full-length books will be out in the Japanese language. So, I think that's really helping because I've discovered giving lectures in Japanese is a real problem. I can't speak Japanese. And my translators, I found, need about three times as much time to translate as I give in my talk. And so it's really hard to communicate much through lectures. But we're doing the best we can. But we're really seeing a real turnaround through a new kind of church. I've met some pastors there who have PhDs that are discovering that a pastor with a PhD in engineering or science is more effective than a pastor with a master's or a PhD in theology. And these gentlemen have been starting new churches, and they've been purposely setting them up to be international in flavor. So they have a lot of expatriates coming from what they call White Tokyo. But every city has got a white community. And they have all these expatriates coming who are typically businessmen and professionals. And then they invite native Japanese to join them. And they have English classes. And what they're doing is they're providing the native Japanese with excuses to come to a church to learn about Jesus Christ. What I discovered when I was in Japan, especially with the men, they wouldn't be caught dead with their friends knowing that they were studying the Christian faith. But they all want to study the Christian faith. There's tremendous hunger in Japan to do that. And so what we do is they say, well, I'm not going to church. I'm going to a place where I can meet foreign businessmen and learn English. But while they're there, they are really there to learn about the Christian faith. And likewise, we're finding our websites very helpful. Of all the nations in the world that hit our website, second to the U.S. is Japan. And the reason why it's working so well is that it gives the Japanese an opportunity to study the Christian faith in secret. And that's part of my story. I don't think I would have ever become a Christian unless I had the opportunity to study the Christian faith secretly. I was raised in Canada, but it's kind of like Japan. You know, studying the Christian faith just puts you way down on the status of people in your peer group. And so for me, it was important that I had the opportunity to study it secretly. And I studied it in secret for 2 years before I told anybody what I was doing. And I think that's what the Japanese need as well. Yes.
In your earlier comments on Mars, you talked about life as we know it. I think a lot of people hold out the hope that we may find extraterrestrial life as we don't know it. Would you care to comment on that?
Okay. And what we have here in these design evidences for the solar system are probabilities based not just on life as we know it, but life by any possible conception. Now, I'm talking physical life. We're not talking angels. We're talking life that's physical, life that would operate within the space-time manifold of our universe. And what we discover, number one, is that life is only possible if the universe is uniform and homogeneous. Okay, if the universe isn't uniform and homogeneous, you don't even get stars and planets. Now, also when we look at what you need to get complex chemistry, I think everybody admits life, no matter how it's put together, is going to involve complex chemistry. And in order to get complex chemistry, you're down to three candidates in the chart of atomic elements. You can build the molecules on boron, you can build them on carbon, you can build them on silicon. Now, silicon was a real favorite 30 years ago because silicon, like hydrogen and oxygen, is very abundant in the universe. It's one of the most abundant elements in the universe, more abundant than carbon. So they said, hey, if we can get something working on silicon, we've already got something going for us. But 30 years ago, they ran experiments and discovered that although you can get complex molecules built in silicon, they're simply not stable. They break down very quickly. In fact, it's impossible to get a stable chemical structure involving anything more than 100 amino acids built on silicon. And that's just not enough to get anything close to life chemistry operating. So silicon's been a non-candidate, leaving just boron and carbon. To this date, the kinds of chemical experiments that are necessary to rule out boron haven't even been done. But there's a reason why they haven't been done. It's the principle of homogeneity and uniformity that's necessary for life, which means there's no hope of finding a boron-rich region in the universe. Boron compared to carbon is quite rare. And if the universe is homogeneous and uniform, that means there's no possibility of finding a spot in the cosmos where boron is not rare compared to carbon, which means there's really no reason to do the experiments built on boron because carbon will always take over. Knowing what you know about the universe, there's no hope for boron-based chemistry to get going because carbon, being so much more abundant, will always invade and take over. So the name of the game is it's got to be carbon-based life. And that's the only assumption we've brought into these probabilities, is that we're looking at carbon-based life. We don't care how many eyes the creature has, where the ears are. Our only concern is the carbon-based chemistry. And in the words of Robert Dickey, the Princeton atheist physicist, he said in a lecture many years ago, if you want astronomers, you've got to make them out of carbon. It's the only way you're going to get astronomers. You've got to build them out of carbon. So, yes.
Do you accept that Mars rock is actually from Mars?
Do I accept that this Mars rock is actually from Mars? We have in our possession as astronomers 13 rocks that we think are from Mars. For each of those 13, there's a 90% probability that they are from Mars and a 10% probability that they're not. So give me any rock that they think is from Mars, there's one chance out of 10 it's not really from Mars. But with 13 rocks, a goodly number of them must be from Mars. Now, how do they conclude that it's a Martian rock? What they'll do is they'll take the rock and look for a little air pocket inside the rock that is indigenous, which means undisturbed. and they'll analyze the composition of the air inside that pocket. And if it perfectly matches the Martian atmosphere, then we say this is a rock that came to Mars from a meteoritic collision on Mars that threw material into outer space and eventually got to Earth. A second check on it is they can determine how long that rock has been orbiting in our solar system. And if it's a very short period of time, then that probably means it's not a true meteorite. But if you get something like 50,000 years or a million years that it's been zipping around the solar system, away from Mars, away from Earth, then yes, it's got to be extraterrestrial. You say, well, how do they figure that out? Well, as a rock is running around our solar, it gets exposed to hard solar radiation. And so we can tell how long it's been exposed to the radiation of outer space compared to the radiation that exists on Mars, which is also substantial but not as great, and then the almost complete lack of radiation at the surface of the Earth. So in that case, that ALH84001 has got more than a 90% probability of being from Mars. The new rock is probably only 9 out of 10. They are looking for more, but they're hard to find. We've only found 13 in the last couple hundred years. Yes, Wes?
I would just like to have you comment on the Stanley Miller's experiments with the prebiotic soup and attempting to explain how life originated. Where is the status of these kind of experiments? Where do we stand with that?
Well, Wes, it's interesting. A couple of weeks ago, I was at the University of Iowa, and they had me speak in the Harold Urey Hall. That was the place where Stanley Miller had been for a number of years, and they named his lecture hall after his mentor, Harold Urey. And the original experiment, they had this little glass flask, and they put water, carbon dioxide, ammonia, and methane in there. And they blasted it with electric sparks, and they were able to get some amino acids out. And this was done back in 1956. And this led to the conclusion, well, that's how life began on the surface of the Earth. There were these primordial molecules in the Earth's atmosphere. There's no ammonia and methane of any consequence in our atmosphere now. But very early on, there probably was. And it said, if you've got lots of lightning bolts going through the atmosphere would rain these amino acids, the amino acids would self-assemble, and you would get the proteins. It doesn't solve the nucleotide problem in the RNA and the DNA, but might explain where you get the proteins. The fine print on this is that they only got one amino acid. There are 20 amino acids that make up a biological protein, and this experiment only produced one, glycine, the simplest of the 20 amino acids. And keep in mind, an amino acid has only got 20 atoms typically in it anyway. It's not that complicated of a molecule. And only the simplest one, glycine, was produced in the experiment, and they only got it on the second run. Miller and Urey ran the experiment 200 times, and only on the second run did they get glycine. On the other 199, they got nothing, which has led some people to conclude this really isn't a simulation of a natural event. What you've got is a controlled design situation going on. Two intelligent scientists carefully controlling the parameters of the flask experiment, and even then they're only successful in one out of 200. I mean, they were doing everything they could to get amino acids by tuning the experiment just right. And they said this isn't a natural simulation. This is a simulation of design. What's the status right now? Well, there's another gentleman by the name of Sidney Fox who's been successful in getting amino acids. So he starts with amino acids, the biological amino acids, sets up something like a flask experiment, and he's able to observe that the amino acids come together. Okay, but they only come together under dry conditions. I say that because the favorite theory for the origin of life today is that it happens under deep ocean steam vents, you know, where you got these underwater volcanoes that are pouring out a lot of heat, and also a lot of ammonia and methane. But as one atheist chemist said when a gentleman was making a presentation, this is how life originated, he said, tell me, sir, where do you get the dry conditions at this deep underwater sea vent? And there was no response, of course. You don't get dry spots in the ocean. So, but yeah, it needs to be dry. It needs to be at a particular temperature. You've got to make sure there's no oxygen around. The slightest amount of oxygen means that it doesn't come together. And again, there are simply a few being joined. We're not duplicating the sequences that we see in these protein molecules. Now, on the other side, Stanley Miller kind of quickly figured out that there wasn't really much to be gained by pursuing the amino acid route. He spent the rest of his career working on the nucleotides, the building blocks of DNA and RNA. And just a couple of years ago, he published a paper, in fact, I got it in my briefcase, where he said he claimed to have synthesized in a flask the two nucleotides they had never been able to synthesize before. It took him about 15 years to get two of the nucleotides. It took him another 25 years to get the other two. There are four that make up DNA and RNA. But there's a problem. Two of those nucleotides require the primordial soup to be freezing. The other two require the primordial soup to be boiling. And where on earth are you going to get a primordial pond that is simultaneously boiling and freezing? And so you've got a roadblock there. And in no case are they able to generate experiments simulating natural conditions where you get all the amino acids left-handed and the nucleotide sugars right-handed. That's never been done. And we don't know of any natural mechanism that will produce a sufficient excess of right-handed nucleotides and left-handed amino acids. The only thing I've seen that works is a circularly polarized light that you get right next to a pulsar or a black hole. But, you know, that's obviously a bad environment to try to make these amino acids is right next to a black hole or a pulsar. The radiation is going to break it down very quickly. And even then, you're only getting like a 3 to 4% favoritism towards left-handed amino acids. For life, you need 100%. A 3 or 4% excess isn't going to do it. It's got to be 100%. And, of course, the worst problem of all is getting the sequences right. And as one chemist calculated almost 30 years ago, in terms of the sequence problem, you're going to need something in excess of 10 to the 100 billion years. That's 100 billion zeros after the one, which really makes the debate between old Earth and young Earth completely trivial. And what I say to my young Earth friends, hey, we only differ by six zeros. The atheists differ from both of us by 100 billion zeros. So why let a factor of a million get between us in any way? Okay. There was a question down here. Yes.
Earth has experienced several mass extinctions.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, had they not occurred, would have life, how would it have evolved? And had one occurred just a few million years ago, we wouldn't even be sitting here. So how does these mass extinctions fit into this scenario?
How do the mass extinctions fit into a biblical creation model? Here's how. The Earth is not that big. If we're any bigger, it wouldn't be able to support life. If we're any smaller, it wouldn't be able to support life. But the surface of the Earth provides you with an upper limit to how many species you can have existing on the planet at any given time. Roughly in the neighborhood of, say, 30 to 40 million species tops. Now, the creation story we see outlined for us in Genesis 1 is something you're not going to squish into just 30 or 40 million species. In fact, the fossil record testifies of something between a half billion and a billion species being created over the history of the planet. Now, if you're talking a creation scenario that requires, say, a billion species, and you say, why do you say require? All right. Our sun is about the stablest star you're going to find. And it's at just the right luminosity for life. But no star is strictly stable. Our sun today is 40% brighter than it was when God first created life on the planet. Now, life on the surface of the Earth cannot tolerate a 40% increase in the luminosity of the sun. It can only tolerate about a 1% increase. And this means that we're going to have some mechanism on the Earth to compensate for the increase in solar luminosity. And that's called the silicate carbonate cycle. Let me try to simplify that for you. What you do is you create...
Thank you. scientists that will discover what will be the next paleontological discovery. The only criticisms I hear at Gone University campuses is that they need previous speakers keep coming, but they never tell us what they believe or why they believe, except they tell us what's wrong with all of our beliefs. There really is a need to go on a campus and go into technical or business firms and produce and present a positive creation model. And that's something we're really committed to doing, reasons to believe. Question back.
Bible tells us that God sees us in a way we can't see or understand ourselves. When Mr. Floyd looks at his life, what does he see? All he sees is a line. Just a long line. That's it. Nothing wants to see what his life looks like in terms of an outline. He's forced to walk all the way around his life and look at the different line segments that he sees. And he uses his two-dimensional brain to kind of put together the sort of two-dimensional outline of his life. Notice in a three-dimensional being, I don't have to go through that piece of gymnastics. I can walk up at his life and I see the entire outline at once. My brain grasps that immediately. But there's something I see that he never sees. I can see everything inside his life. Notice he can only see the outside of his wife. That's it. And I can see everything inside, as well as outside. So God sees us in a way we can't see one another. Now obviously he's able to look in and see all the aspects of our soul and spirit. Now when I look at Tom here, all I see is his body. I don't see his soul. I don't see his spirit. I do know that his soul and spirit are residing within his body, but I can't see it. God can see everything about our soul and our spirit. He knows how we feel before we know how we feel. So he understands and sees our selfishness in a way we can't perceive. I don't know what it's like with you, but so I'm married, and sometimes my wife identifies my feelings long before I can identify them. And we're the other way around, too. God instantly sees that. It takes us time to perceive what's going on inside our soul and our spirit, and even then the information is incomplete. Ever anybody ask you, how do you feel? You say, I don't know. I need a little more time to figure out how I feel. That's a very human experience. God knows immediately. Okay. That's one way to kind of give an illustration of that. And what I try to do in the book is also give some ideas of how you can get a better illustration of some of the aspects of the Trinity. The one thing you can do is put a finger through the plane. And Mr. Flapp will come over and say, Hugh Ross is a small circle. I could put three fingers through the plane for Mrs. Flapp, and she would say, Hugh Ross is three small circles. And we can imagine Mr. and Mrs. Flapp having a theological debate. Is it three? Is it one? Is it three? Is it one? They never agree. And what happens is, Mr. Flapp knows the church of the one circle, and Mrs. Flapp knows the church of the three circles. Which is what has happened universally outside of the Christian faith. There are religions that believe there's one and only one God. There are religions that believe there are many gods. But only in Christianity do we say that God is one and three at the same time. It's impossible in four dimensions. Not impossible once we recognize God's extra-dimensional capacities. If the Trinity is like couldn't perceive in their two dimensions, and that these three fingers will be seen capable in their perspective of totally independent motion, respect to one another, form one single three-dimensional closed surface that we call my hand. I'm one hand here. So in that sense, my hand is three and one at the same time. Now the threeness and oneness of God goes beyond this analogy I'm giving you, and it kind of helps you get the point across. Over here. One area that I've had the most difficulty, really the only area that I've had the most difficulty accepting of different ideas, and that is of the limited flood. You would explain it in terms of being a localized flood, in a basin. And yet the scriptures talk about the waters covering the highest mountains. You can't cover the mountains. And again, it's a highest object in the middle of the basin. And geologically, within a span of time that encompasses mankind on the earth, is there any evidence of such a basin, particularly in the area related to in the Bible, that there ever was such a basin that would hold that water? And secondly, there's a theological issue associated with that in the scriptures referring to all life. And parallels in the New Testament, paralleling our salvation to Christ with the flood, and that only eight were saved through
geography that's elevated above the plains. Now the adjective de Gore, translated highest, the translation you quoted from, also has literal definitions, elevated. So it could be all the elevated hills. And not all translations will throw in the word highest. Now the verb cover, it's kasam. It's got three possible definitions. It could refer to 22 feet of water permanently residing over the hills. Or it could be 22 feet of water running over the hills. Or it could be referring to 22 feet of water falling upon the hills. So it could be a heavy rainfall. It could be a flood rush over. Or it could be a permanent deposit. And the text doesn't tell you which of the three options it is. I don't think it's necessary that all three options would guarantee the total destruction of all human beings and all the birds and animals associated with them. If you've got that much water falling that fast in 40 days, it will be total destruction. There was a rainstorm in India where 4 feet fell in one day. And that was total destruction. No survivors. All buildings were collapsed. So again, 22 feet. If it's rain, it will destroy everything. If it's 22 feet running at you at 30 miles an hour over the hills, again, there'll be no survivors. If it's permanent water, there'll be no survivors. So, and then it says all the mountains under the entire face of the earth. That's, I think, is what's caused most people to be troubled. Because it seems to be referring to the entire earth. Well, you can go to like Hebrews 8, 4 through 6, and what you'll discover is that the waters are now receding. In fact, they've been receding for many months. And Noah's on top of the ark, and he can see the hills. So the hills are visible to him. He releases a dove, and when you see a verse later, in the context of the dove, the text says there is water over the entire face of the earth. So it's all based on perspective. From the dove's perspective, all the dove could see was water. From Noah's perspective, he could see the hills. So in the context of Genesis 7:19, what it means is that the height of the flood, those 8 people on board the ark could not see any land at all. All they could see was water. Number one, that's the other. Number two, that's the other end of the earth.
It says, from now on, you and your descendants must restrain. And this is where he
instituted the death penalty for murder. Now, that's a mandatory sentence that has a limit. If that's what it takes to keep murder in check, use it. It's a mandate for the government, not for the individuals. That's what was going on in days before the flood. People were taking matters into their own hands and killing everybody. This murder must be restrained. And by the way, that's an important read that stated first. You don't restrain murder, you're not going to fill the earth. You have to restrain murder. I said, with murder under control, I want you to take seriously what I said before. You must fill the earth. And yet we see 2 chapters later that mankind would say, we're not going to fill the earth. We're going to build this city and its power so we will not be scattered over the face of the earth. We're going to remain as one people in one place. And God said, no, you're not. And he destroyed their city, their tower, and forcibly scattered them over the face of the earth. The other thing I point out in this book is that the geographical structures of the earth did not permit the spreading of humanity over the whole face of the earth until 13,000 years ago. There's a window between 14 and 11,000 years ago when there was a bridge connecting Siberia to Alaska. And that during those couple of thousand years, it was only about 10,000 years and the bridge was warm. So there'd be food on both sides and along the bridge as well. To allow human beings to settle in the North and South America. And then what's really interesting is that geophysics tells us that the bridges rapidly broke. The sea levels rose 33 feet a century. We're talking about this 400-year interglacial, but it gets something pretty rapid at the other end when the glacial ends. And as long as going on, these land bridges quickly formed and quickly collapsed, thereby guaranteeing that humanity would not repeat the errors of the days before the flood and remain as one people, united, one government, one place. And God
reason that I've not come to bring peace. It's not the right time for peace. I've come first to bring the message of salvation. If you receive that message, then world peace. If that's not world peace first, world peace first, you get a repeat of the sun. I'm also passing a notice that there are no geographical place names in Genesis outside of the region of Mesopotamia until you get Genesis 10. So the scrolling clue that humanity has remained localized. If humanity is localized, you can destroy the whole lot of them with a local flood. And you can destroy all the birds and animals associated with them with a local flood. Now, in terms of that region, is there evidence that there are flood deposits in there? There's a lot of evidence. In fact, there are six deep flood deposits in the Mesopotamian Valley. And by the way, Mesopotamia is wide enough and long enough that you're in an arc. And it's well flooded. You're not going to see any hills or mountains. All you're going to see is water everywhere. That valley is five times wider than the San Joaquin Valley. And even the San Joaquin Valley, if you're in the middle, you can't see the high mountains on both sides.
that's what the appeals board, if they became a surrender role, they said, well, you know, since we don't know, since we can't see, maybe we contribute to the cost. But what the Heisenberg and survey principle really says is that a human observer is incapable of seeing the fullness of the cause and effect effect that's going on. It's hidden from us. There is a cause and effect taking place. And God, who's beyond the space, time, manifold, the universe, can see the entirety of it. And for the human observer within the space, time, manifold, the universe, it's hidden. There's a big difference between saying it's hidden and we cause it. And I think ultimately the real problem behind some of the Buddhist and Hindu concepts is that, if we can really do those things as human beings, then the universe should bring up a whole lot different than it does. And it doesn't. Now, the universe seems to function very well without us being here at all. And we're kind of like, we're just observers of this whole thing. We don't affect anything. Do you have a follow-up to that, or is that pretty well helping out? Okay. I'll add one more comment. I think it's critical to this thing. Within these movements is the idea that the universe came into existence through a quantum fluctuation. And where you can expose that is that the probability for a quantum event taking place is proportional to how much time you've got. The bigger the time interval, the higher the probability for the quantum event taking place. As proportional to mass, the more mass you want to come into existence through a quantum fluctuation of the space-time manifold, and by the way, that's physically possible. You can make matter out of space through these quantum fluctuations. That really can happen. But the uncertainty principle tells us that the matter you make has got to return to the space-time curvature before the human observer can tell that it's there. And the more you try to bring into existence, the faster it's going to go out of existence. Now, we're talking universe. The step back time is 10 to the minus 122 seconds. It's got to go back into the space-time curvature at less than 10 to the minus 122. So if that
to use that as a methodology for convincing secular society and people of the religions that this indeed is the error-free word of God. We're not told to look for goats. We're told to avoid the goats. Like the point strong is so common we can think about there in the Bible about the other.
I can't hear thinking that the world wasn't, you know, the universe and the whole thing was about 4,500 years old by this young Earth believer. And I can understand how your concept of the how it could be around the universe be around for like a million years. So how did that fall in where Kent in the book of Genesis talks about how God created in order like one through the 6 days and the rest of the did he recreate the Earth for human life?
Stars and galaxies. The cosmos is filled with light from tens of light.
of creation is to think of man as a state between Genesis 1:3 that God created light on the first creation day. That's not what the text says. It says, let there be light. Uses the verb hayah, not the verb arah. God did not create light on the first day. That light was allowed to come through the atmosphere to the surface of the earth. The atmosphere is transformed from being opaque to translucent. When you get to the fourth day, again, it doesn't say that God created cosmos. It's not limited to the entirety of the cosmos.